That's all right. Carol, thank you very much for joining with me this morning. This morning, this is over the course of the last week, we've been having discussions about death and dying and our culture and how we experience it. And today is kind of more the practical aspect of it, advanced medical directives. And it's really, I hope to share some information with you about why it is that they don't work very well. A number of studies have been done to show that when people fill out advanced directives, that the people that they love, as they put for the person who's supposed to be their voice, if they can't speak for themselves, given the same scenario, you know, they'll sit down in a room and say, come on, we're just starting. Just explain it. What we'll do today is talk about it, the practical part of how to improve, to do the best you can to help at the end of life to make it the way you want it to be. And advanced directives is kind of one of the avenues that's been used and been brought up a lot. In 1990, a federal law was passed. The result of a number of cases that names that we all you're all familiar with. I don't know about Wangley, but Terri Ann Quinlan. And that law was passed, and the point of that law was so that people could have choices about their health care, direct their health care, even when they couldn't speak for themselves. It's been since 1990, and there's been a lot of studies on them, and they don't work very well. They just don't really do what they were designed, what we were hoping they would do. We were hoping that you could write down what you wanted, somebody would read them, and then be able to carry it out. Turns out, you could say, you can say what you want, write it down. The people used to appoint to be your guardian to carry out your wishes. Here's the same scenario, so you hear two different scenarios. And it turns out, well over half the time, quite a bit more than that actually, they don't pick the same things. They just don't say the same treatment options, right? You fill them out, and physicians wait until you can't talk anymore, and then look at your healthcare directives, right? Healthcare directives, so there's a number of ways in which they've looked at healthcare directives to see that they don't work very effectively. That said, I still want to try to convince you at the end to fill one out, okay? Because they can be a useful tool. But I just wanted to start, kind of launch into it by saying, why is it so hard to die? What is it like to die in this country? What are the kinds of things that you all, that I will be facing in these next few years? What has changed over the years? Well, pretty dramatically, these are a few statistics from 2070. The median age of death in our country in 2007 was 78. You know, if you add them all up, the median age. If you get past 65, however, it jumps up to 82 years. In that, the difference between 200 years ago was 35. So 200 years ago, people lived to about an age of 35 or so. Now we live to the age of 78. So our modern healthcare system has given us the gift of longevity. It really, along with the resources the modern healthcare system needs, but it has brought us to 78, which is an amazing accomplishment, a wonderful accomplishment. 4.5 million people approximately now are over 85. This is at last year, 4.5.
In the United States or in the world?
As the United States. In 2030, that will jump to 9 million. So it'll double in about the next 20 years.
Older than 85?
Yes, older than 85. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you could imagine Pearly Gates, right? And there's a line there. Imagine St. Peter with kind of a stern look on his face, looking over the top. Stern look at his face, and then person down there with a cane and a suitcase saying, yes, I'd have been here earlier if it hadn't been for early detection. Right? We're just stretching it out, that inevitable journey that we all have. Right? But there has come, there's been a cost. The cost in terms of, a question was asked a couple of sessions ago, you know, are we better off because we live longer? And I can say honestly, yes, we are. And honestly, I don't know that we are both at one time. Yes, we're around longer, we have better, I mean, overall we are. We have more time with those people we love. We enjoy that time quite a bit. We're able to be interactive in it. But when it comes to the end, to the last year of life, well, in many ways we've increased the amount of suffering in that last year of life. The last year of life used to happen, people would be healthy for most of it and then get sick and die very quickly. A few statistics about that last year of life now. Well, just before you get to the last year of life, in a study done in 2000, there are about 7 million people over the age of 85 with activity of daily living skills that were limited. In other words, just getting around and doing what you needed to. About seven million people struggled with that. In hospital uses, there was a study done in hospitals, the five leading teaching hospitals. Patients who were in the hospital 8 to 12 days, those patients were looked at. 60% of them, 60% of colon cancer patients, 60% of liver failure, 57% of lung cancer patients, and the list goes on, and they're all above 50. All those patients experienced, after 8 to 12 days, moderate to severe pain. So, if you're in these hospitals, if you went in with any diseases and you stayed about 8 to 12 days, you could expect moderate to severe pain that you'd have to endure.
You mean it was uncared for pain, or, I mean,
patients,
pain like after?
Patients expressed that they had moderate to severe pain, yeah. Well, uncared for.
Palliative care is pretty incredible these days.
It is, but it's still a very new field with very limited kind of reach to it. You could easily have lung cancer and be in the hospital 8 to 12 days and not be on a palliative care service at all, depending on what kind of treatment you're getting. But the point is that there is a great deal of suffering that happens with our modern healthcare system. We can't deny that, and it's a very difficult thing for us to address. The stress that puts on in this last years of living, the stress that's put on folks, about 250 million caregivers will deliver care at home to a seriously ill relative. At working at least 18 hours a week, 87% of them will say that they need more help. 33% of them will state that they're in poor health themselves. If you were to assume about an $8 an hour, pay them $8 an hour, that'd be $194 billion that would have been paid out to those folks. About 70% of them will be women who will be doing that health care. The effects on the families, impact on families, about in need of large amount of, those folks who stay, they need a lot of care. It's about 34%. Lost major family savings, about 31% of them. Lost major source of income, about 29%. And all of these that I mentioned, were on Medicare and were insured. So this last years of our life, there's a great deal of energy that gets spent by families to try to take care of people, a great deal of energy around those issues. And it's hard for the medical community, for our larger community, to address those kinds of issues. That's one of the reasons why thinking about healthcare directives is a really valuable thing, because whatever you and I can do personally to help address those issues will be appreciated if they're needed. Okay, that's the dour part. One last thing you got to, Imagine all those numbers of how many people will be aging and the aging. So you imagine Superman. This is a Gary Larson cartoon. You know Gary Larson, he's always up there. Gary Larson, Superman standing in the window. He's definitely an octogenarian. He's kind of a little wizened. And he's looking over his shoulder and he says something effective. Dang, Lois, where did I say I was going? And I think that's great because I think that just really hit it because in many ways, folks who are 65 to 85 have an amazing, do a lot of things. They are really engaged and involved in the world. And at the same time, they struggle with the reality of bodies that having regenerated themselves so many times, are having difficulty in functioning. So I thought that's a great image. So why is it so hard? What makes it so hard? How come you can't just write out what you want and have it happen? How come you get in a hospital and you can't get your pain taken care of? I mean, what's going on? Why is it that we can't take care of those basic things? Right? Well, one of the reasons is because we don't speak the same language as healthcare folks. Here's what happens is, here you got you get an illness, say a life-limiting illness of some kind starts here. You get diagnosed with a cancer or renal failure, some those kinds of things. You're going along, and the healthcare system's goal is to cure you. Whoop, we can't cure that one. So we're going to try to extend your life as long as we can. And when it comes down to it, we are going to try to save your life. Because this is modern healthcare's, this has been their driving mission, and born out of a desperate need, watching infants die, pregnant women die, watching lots of things, illness, disease happen. Born out of that desperate need, these three things drive healthcare. And I am so grateful for them. My dad has needed surgery in his heart. He got an infection in his sternum, and he came very close to dying. And he would have died had there not been this overriding writing approach to him. He got those, they aren't so new now, they were antibiotic beads that were put literally in his chest as it laid open to get rid of the infection. Okay? This, my little waif of a niece, skinny little thing, came home and complained about having side ache. Okay, dear, go to bed. So she went to bed, got up, well, it was a little bit, but it was a little better, it wasn't so good. Okay, dear, go to school. Well, she came home early. Finally, she got sicker and sicker. They took her in, and her appendix had burst, right? Not that she didn't have the, she was just the, you know. If they had not had this, she would not be here because they had antibiotics that they could immediately put into her that beat the infection, and she would have died of sepsis or infection. There's no question about it. This is really good stuff. And this is the language of healthcare. This is one of the reasons physicians have such a difficult time talking to their patients about the end-of-life things. They will, on an average, take physicians, and I think this study is pretty new. I'll share it with you in a second. About 1.5 classes on how to help people do this last part. Okay? I mean, so in their education, they'll get a class or two on how to help people when they come to this point where you can't, where this, and this don't work. And then we have hospice over here. But hospice, even the best program, is linked with this. Okay? Even the best program is that, because that's that you have, in order to hospice, you have to answer that question. Your physician has to be able to say, I would not be surprised if in 6 months or less, given the trajectory of this illness, given the normal course of this illness, that a person would die, that I would be, it was my physician, that Mark would be dead. I wouldn't be surprised by that. When that question is answered that way, then you can get on hospice. So for many people, this word hospice is linked directly to this. What happens is hospice, and there's a movement now that Carol mentioned called palliative care that wants to add this. Palliative care wants to add this. Of suffering. Okay? Palliative care wants to add that in there. Because this is not a part of the focus of this. Okay? And to add that in, so that comes as a part of that illness process. But that's a long way, that's a thing that will be coming for a long time. So how do you help people in this translation? These folks are speaking a language that we don't speak very clearly. And I just want to show you just the difference in language. This is a
About 3 years ago, I had a parishioner who really didn't have any local family, and she called me up. She said that she had just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was going in to visit her oncologist for the first time. And so I volunteered to go with her. And she described to me what her general practitioner had explained to her would be the course of her treatment. So me liking to use the computer, I looked that up and realized that the kind of breast cancer that she had was very aggressive, mm-hmm. and was not the standard kind. Mm-hmm. And so I went in with her to the oncologist. Mm-hmm. And the oncologist is this bouncy, cheerful, oh, you're going to be just fine, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And there's not going to be any problems. And I knew what she wanted. I knew that if she could not live a full life, she didn't want to go through all the crap. Mm-hmm. And so I pushed him. Mm-hmm. I pushed him and I said, well, now tell me, you know, what is the prognosis that she's going to come through all of this treatment and then be able to not go into a nursing home and be able to live a full life? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's going to be just fine. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel ethically that I didn't know how far I should push.
Yep, you bet. That's a confusing situation. It would be hard.
It was a very confusing situation, mm-hmm. but he was not honest with her. I don't believe he was honest with her. He did not explain that she had the most difficult kind of cancer there was, and of breast cancer.
Right.
And we went through it. She went through. She had her surgery. She had her chemo.
Right.
Or she had her chemo and then her surgery. And she has not had a well day since.
Right. Mm. It's very difficult. That's a excellent example of just how difficult the situation is. Mm-hmm. And I really want, as I present this, really want to say, I do not mean to present it as if there are bad guys and good guys. I do not mean to present it as if physicians need to just buck up and finally tell the truth. And I do not mean to present it as if patients just need to ask for stuff. Hearing what you said, it is a very complex thing. Mm-hmm. It is different when I come in with this sore in my side and they say, oh, you have gallbladder problems. Would you like to have surgery to take care of the gallbladder? They always give you choices in healthcare. Would you like to have surgery?
I don't know. Let me think about it for a while.
Well, I know it's a choice, but it isn't a choice, is it? You're going to take care of the gallbladder. And you have gallbladder surgery, okay? And that's not really that complex. You don't have to speak exactly the same language. Take care of the pain? Yes, okay? It's done, you go home. They do the gallbladder surgery and it isn't a pain from a gallbladder. It's actually metastasized cancer that had been undiagnosed because it was around your gallbladder. And then it gets complicated. It gets very complicated. What do you do next? Who tells what? That's when the surgeon says, I want the chaplain to go in with me. He wouldn't ask me if it was just the gallbladder. I guarantee you. Okay? We better call his wife, make sure his wife's here. If it was a good, easy gallbladder, you wouldn't have had to do that. Okay? It gets complicated. And that's exactly what can. I've been with a physician who was a patient had adult respiratory distress syndrome. In other words, his lungs have been giving out, he was weak, and there's a multiple number of things that happen to your heart, to your lungs, to your blood sugar, to a number of different body systems at one time. And the possibility of recovering from that is not very large at all. Given the fact that he was of his age and his previous conditions, he probably wasn't going to. When I was in the room, the physician said to his daughter, his relative, he's not out of the woods yet. Mm-hmm. When I went, I finished the conversation, happened to be at the desk when the doctor was charting, and I said, well, so he's not out of the woods. What are we kind of looking at? Oh, he won't make it. He won't survive. But the physician, I said, but you told him, you know, well, I was just shocked. Like, but you just said, not out of the woods. Yeah, but I didn't want to take their hope away. See, feel the complexity of it? He's a genuinely good physician. He could take care of me and my family anytime. He's not a liar, but he struggled with the situation that was, and what does that mean? On the other hand, did the family deserve to know where he was at? Mm-hmm. You feel it? Now the study, I wanna just take this study, take it with you, and I encourage you to take it with you and read it and kind of think about it. It's really an amazing thing, some of these studies do. This one's done in the Journal of Palliative Medicine. In other words, it's a journal that wants to try to improve that area right there. Okay? And it was done trying to understand how physicians communicate with patients. What happens there? And it's about facing the uncertainty of death, diagnosing death. When you get an illness, you want to say to the doc, how long do I have? Okay? Now it sounds like a reasonable question, and it is. It is a reasonable question. How long do I have? What does this mean, right? But it's very difficult for physicians to tell you that. It's difficult because individuals do respond differently, and it's difficult because it's a very emotional question. There's a lot in it, okay? On the other hand, who else has the best understanding of what you can expect? Okay. So look at in this study, it says 42.8% of the physicians said they felt certain upon admission or the first meeting of the patient that the patient would die during the hospitalization, with 38.3% reporting that they were uncertain. Okay. So the physician, these are patients that died, by the way, that came in the hospital and died. Okay. So look at the large, these are all competent physicians looking at same types of patients. 11% of the physicians reported having personally spoken to the patient about the possibility of their dying. Whoa. Is there a gap there? 48% were reasonably certain. 11% of the total had any kind of conversation that they thought there's a possibility that they might die. While 33% reported believing that someone on the medical team had done so. I didn't, but I know the nurse did, or the chaplain, or the social worker. There was no relationship was found between the physician and the patient's variables and whether or not the physician recognized death was imminent. However, patients whose physicians were certain of imminent death were three times more likely to have told this possibility to the patients than those physicians who were uncertain about it. And there's more information that follows. It's just, and the key that they focused on was communication, the need for communication on these issues, okay? The study on the back, okay, that's one of the physicians struggle with it. The study on the back is how patients struggle with it. It's a prospective study on health status, preferences, and changes in preferences over time in older adults. They said we speak their own language in healthcare. bottom line is they did this, they did the study to try to figure out if, as you got older, did you change your preferences, right? The conclusion was for some patients, and when they say that they mean a statistically significant number, the acceptability of treatments resulting in certain diminished status of health increased over time, and increased acceptability is more likely among patients experiencing a decline in that same domain. So in other words, I can start out by saying, you know, I don't want to be kept alive on machines, I just don't want that kind of treatment. Okay? When the time comes for that kind of treatment, I will be more likely to say, well, you know, maybe I will have that kind of treatment. Okay? So for example, have you ever heard Tuesdays with Maury, that book? Tuesdays with Maury? It's a great book. It's about really good sociology professor who had really connected with some students, and one of his students turned out to be quite a good writer. The young man was quite cynical about life, and then he found out that this teacher of his was dying, and he made a trip every Tuesday, flew back across country to visit this teacher of his over the course of his dying, and that really changed this young man's life. And one of the things that, in the course of that, Maury, who was dying of ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a progressive illness the connection between your nerves and your ability to use them is broken. The connection gets broken, so you just can't lift your arms anymore. But you're perfectly lucid the whole time, perfectly, completely clear the whole time, and eventually you end up your lungs stop. You can't breathe anymore. And along the way, Maury had said very clearly that he wanted his life to end when he couldn't wipe himself. When he couldn't, that was his dignity level right there. He could not wipe himself. He was trying to make plans that he could end his life. Okay? As he went through his illness process, he learned and kept learning. He kept reflecting on what was going on, talking with those people he loved. Things changed. So when that point came, that was no longer the final marker for him. He wanted to remain alive to be with those people who loved him. Okay? And that's a great example. And from my own experience, I could tell you a number of examples of how that happens. Is that if you're ill with something, you learn to accommodate. We are have an amazing ability to accommodate. So me feeling healthy, looking down the road, says, I never want to be in that place. But as I get there, I have accommodated. I find out that I still can really enjoy life, even though I can't climb the mountain anymore. I certainly can look at it. You know, we learn to accommodate a lot, and so those change. So you see how the difficulty is that it's not just that physicians won't talk to us; it's that they're not trained in how to talk to us, and then it's very hard to figure it out. It's not that it's our opinions of what we want change along the way, too. You told somebody who really wanted to know what was going on. The next person who walks in with the same kind of illness could be a person who doesn't want to talk about it at all. How do you know? It's really okay. That's why I'd like to ask us to look at advanced healthcare directives, because they are one of the places where we can train ourselves to have the kinds of conversations we need to have. Okay? They aren't, in all those studies mentioned, there's lots of studies on how they aren't not effective in terms of, you know, I want this, getting what you want. Okay? But there are two areas in which they are consistently effective. Consistent. And by the way, they're better for nursing home patients than they are for hospitalized patients. But there's two areas where they are consistently effective. One is the families, when people fill out advanced directives, turn them in, families report when it's all over, they say, you know, they did everything they could for mom. And that physician really knew we had a good relationship with our physician. We could really talk with our physician. Okay? Even though, when they fill them out and have those conversations, they get less procedures. Actually, they do get less procedures than the people who don't fill them out. They still report that everything was done. Okay? What a wonderful thing to be able to do. for those who live afterwards to say we did what we could. The other one is that, and closely related, is that the family, when they are done, when everything is done, the family say, I know I did what mom and dad wanted me to do, or mom or dad, or my brother. I did what they wanted. Even though we can't correlate that, again, if you just talked about it, you might get different things. Families say, I did what they want. Okay. Those are two very valuable things, right? For those people who live after you, whom you love, to say, I did what I could, and I did what mom wanted. Because what that helps is, that helps them to continue living their life. Which is, of course, what we all want for ourselves and for those we love most, right? It helps them steer the course, their course. So, when I presenting on these things, it isn't about getting what you want, okay, in healthcare. It doesn't work quite that way. It's about giving a gift to those people who are walking with you. It's about helping them navigate this difficult course that they're going to be on. I just want to, we'll get. I want to underline this by, as I pass this out, I'm going to read kind of a, there you go. This is, we'll go over this quickly, it'll illustrate that language gap I was talking about. As you pass them on, I got to read to you, Mac, you ever seen any Maxine stuff? This lady? She's on a lot of greeting cards, kind of humorous. This is Maxine's advanced directive. I, Maxine, being of sound mind and body, do not wish to be kept alive indefinitely on artificial means. Under no circumstances should my fate be put in the hand of pinhead politicians who can't pass ninth grade biology if their lives depended on it, or lawyers or doctors interested in simply running up bills. If a reasonable amount of time passes and I fail to ask for at least one of the following, a glass of wine, chocolate, a margarita, fried chicken, steak, cold beer, chocolate, chicken fried steak, shrimp, Mexican food, chocolate, French fries, Italian food, pizza, chocolate, ice cream, Coke, chocolate, Chinese food, sex, chocolate. It should be presumed that I won't get better. When such determination is reached, I hereby instruct my appointed person and intending physician to pull the plug, ruin the tubes, let the fat lady sing, and call it a day. What I pass out is what we've been talking about. The first sentence, your labile affect may exacerbate your SOB. First time I heard a physician talk about it, the patient with the SOB, I thought, oh, shortness of breath. That's what that stands for, shortness of breath. Oh, okay. In other words, when I cry hard, it's hard to breathe. Okay? Same meaning. So generally, when healthcare providers have conversations with patients, what they focus on is accomplishing a task, making a specific choice, protecting specific rights for their patients. So conversations with physicians are often about technical descriptions that seek rational conclusions. Okay? You could explain why I need a gallbladder operation, probably cite a couple of tests that they've done, so that what? We can reach the rational conclusion and I'll have my gallbladder operation, right? It would be irrational of me to say, no, I don't want a gallbladder operation. I want this. I just want this. I don't care. I just want it. I mean, people can certainly do that, but most of us say, you know, that doesn't make, anyway. Healthcare providers see advanced medical directives. So healthcare providers see the advanced medical directives primarily as addressing the physician, the physical issues about a patient's dying. Most of the time, when physicians look at these, they're saying, we need to make a rational decision here, okay? So, and this will assist the family if we make this rational decision. So they ask questions like, have you considered making out a living will? That's the old language. We don't use that language anymore because it was so confusing. But do you want us to try to start your heart again if it stops? Okay. Technical questions to get information to make a rational decision. And I'll flip it over there. So generally patients and families, however, focus on something quite differently. Patients focus on the personal meaning of their injury or illness. They want to discern the implications for their lives and their families. They want to balance the need, their own needs and their family's needs.
I think that's a critical factor, that sense of balance, that it's both the needs of the living and the dying that are really important. I mean, one of the things that I have said, I have heard so much recently the language of, well, I don't want them to be sad when I die. So you know, don't have a funeral, don't have a visitation, you know, don't let them see my body because that might make them cry. And I said to an awful lot of people, is that really what will be best for your family, to not have the ability to slowly disconnect from who you are, let go?
One of the interesting things about our culture, and I think how well we've used healthcare to keep us living longer, is that we live with the illusion that we can control dying and that we can control what happens afterwards. So that I can say, I don't want a funeral, as if I can control something that comes after I'm gone.
But people feel they're obligated to honor that.
Sure they do, because we all live with the same illusion. So healthcare directives, the quote right about illness is not something that happens to my body, it's something that happened to my life, okay, to my whole life. Now, when we talk about, when I get sick, I think about, well, how will it affect my work? How, you know, what about my family, the vacation we're going to go on, all those things. When you go into the healthcare system, they're thinking about specifically very much more technical things. They're interested in the body and the interrelationships in a body. Okay? Healthcare system often uses language of conflict. You know, we're going to beat this cancer. And on the set, families often use the language of relationship. How is this going to affect? What's it going to mean? I'm going to stay alive until my daughter graduates. Okay? That's relationship. So I want to pass out now. And that, by the way, that's very helpful. That I found that anytime you go into a physician, and of course individual physicians are a different approach, but remember the physician, the healthcare system, is often thinking about technical things, specific kinds of things, very specific, and they're speaking a language that oftentimes we have to you have to get it translated. You have to kind of figure out what that means. You know, you hear the doctor and you understand all the words, and at the end, you're not sure what they meant. Or you just want to say, okay, is that good or bad? What you just said? You know, tell me, is it good? Should I be happy about that or not? Now, for the last few minutes, I'd like to, how much time do we have here? Oh, we've got time. This is a healthcare directive. Healthcare directive consists of, to make a legal healthcare, the federal law said that every state has to make their own rules, okay? So it's different from state to state. However, these basic components have to be there, the law says. The law says that you have to, one, we have to know who you are. Okay, so you have to have your name, and you have to have a social security number, or some identifying information about exactly who you are, okay? Then the law says, we want you to tell us who you want to speak for you if you can't speak for yourself. We call that an agent, okay? Three, the law says, tell us what you want. What you want to have happen to you or not have happen to you, okay? Those are instructions. And then the law says, okay, we got to make sure that we know it's you. So you have to make it legal, and you can do that either by a notary public or by having two witnesses. And almost every state, those two witnesses, they say, can't be someone who would inherit your estate. So, you know, you could be at coffee and have two friends who witness you signing it. Okay? So it has to be legal. Okay? So, this is... So healthcare directives, so what I'm saying is that basically we take this basic format and that what we do when we fill them out is we make them a tool to help the people who are having to make those decisions. We make them a tool thinking about the people we love and how do we help them make the decisions that we want. We could be, you can be specific, but if you have to think about it again in context of who's going to be making those decisions. Most of us, most people will ask the people who love them the most to make those decisions. And of course, you can feel that bind, can't you? I think one of the reasons it's so hard to make those decisions is because I love you the most, and now you're asking me to make these really hard decisions. It's really hard to make those decisions. So I'd like to walk through this healthcare directive with you. And this one does not focus, as many do, on, do I want artificial resuscitation? Do I not want that? Do I want them to start my heart again? Do I not want that? Check the boxes. This one really focuses on the relationships. So if you grab it there, I'll just walk through it and highlight some of the issues along the way. Okay. First one up here is personal information. The second one, what I call part one in here, is naming your agent. To my family, physicians, and those concerned with my health care, when I cannot make my own choices, it's official. I trust Eve, my wife, to make all my healthcare decisions if I am not able to make them myself. If the situation arises when Eve cannot make those decisions, then I want my two children to make them. Of course, I've talked to them and they are aware of my wishes. So what's brought up right away is the people you want to make that choice, okay, and talking to them. If you don't talk to them about those choices, it ain't going to make a difference. It really isn't. You have to have communicated with them, this is what I mean by this, dear. These are some of the things. Because I'll guarantee you, no matter how well you know yourself, you write down what you want on here, the specifics, it won't happen that way. It's just too complex. There's too many things involved. They'll say, oh, and we have a new procedure that can do this and this. How about that? It's not on here. So talking to them about what you want is essential. It goes on to say, I know that it'll be difficult, so I'm depending on both my family, Eve, and my healthcare providers to make sure that the information and the support they get will be there. When you gotta make this legal is when you get done with it, give it to those people you love, but you also, of course, give it to your doctor, right? So your doctor reads. So this is, your doctor is gonna read this too. And when you show up in the hospital, it'll be on your chart, and they'll read it too. So now, they're listening in on a conversation you're having with your loved ones about the kind of care you want. What does that do? It forces them to be relational. It takes that step so that they see, oh, I gotta support the family. Not that, that people would be thinking that, but it makes it, they think that, they think it that way. To my family, as the healthcare community is asking you to make decisions about treatments and procedures, please keep in mind that the single most important thing, okay, there's absolutely no decision that you can make that could change this. I love you and I trust you. That is the single most important thing because it is the foundation for all the choices. Isn't that what we hope the foundation for our choices in our daily living are? I mean, of course, we don't always do those things, but that's what we want. That's what God asks us to be about. Okay. I know that healthcare decisions you are being asked are not easy, but I love you and I trust that God will be there with you and with me as God has always been. I want you to know that if I or your mother could make these decisions, we would. However, We can't, and I want you to know that I have no doubt or fear that you will do the best you can, given the situation. You can't make a bad or wrong decision. Okay? Now, here's overwhelmingly, in my experience, when I'm sitting with the families in intensive care, and they're having to work these things through, overwhelmingly, kids are worried about making the wrong decision. Here's why. Our healthcare community is based on the medical community has this legal underpinning around it. And the underpinning is that the language of choice. That is, patients have rights, and they have to choose. I can't make them do something. They have to choose. So that language is put on all of the healthcare things, but it's not accurate. It doesn't reflect the whole picture. The example I gave earlier, I have this pain. Do you want the gallbladder operation or not? Okay. Well, imagine me right now, I've got pain and it turns out to be a cancer of some kind. Do you want more treatments or not, Mark? Well, what do you mean? Of course there's choices to be made, right? Well, are there really what kind of choices? I have things that I need to be doing for 6 months. Will it get me to 6 months? Yes, there are choices, but inside of us, we feel compelled. Let me tell you, if you're a mother with breast cancer and you've got little kids, and somebody says, you can make the choice of whether you're going to have chemo or not, is that really a choice? Well, yes, but is it? Or are you going to stay alive for those kids as long as you possibly can? See what I'm saying? Problem is that the word choice doesn't quite make it. It doesn't fill up the whole thing. And we get ourselves in trouble because I guarantee you that there is no physician who will ever allow someone to stop treatment if they in their heart believe that this person could survive this and could get back at things. There's just no way. It doesn't work that way. You just can't walk in and say, well, they've got an advanced directive. We were just in a car accident. You've got an advanced directive. He doesn't want you to start his heart again. So don't do it. They just aren't going to listen to you. They're going to try to start my heart because I was in this traumatic event, and they want to see if they can bring me back. If they can't, that's when they sit down with the family and say, we're going to have to make some decisions now, right? If you hear some physician in that kind of say, we have to make some decisions, there really aren't a lot of decisions they're talking about. What they really mean most of the time is, how would you like? We've come to the point where our healthcare system cannot keep this person you love alive. How would you like us to help this person die with the most dignity possible? Okay. When families make those decisions, when they're sitting around, so when the children are in that intensive care room, when they realize, when they can discern, when they can step back, language of faith, discerning God's will, when they can step back and say, you know, Mom really is dying. That's right. I mean, we can get her through this, but she's really dying. How would Mother want her days to be? Then it changes, okay? Then you make different kinds of choices along the way. That's when these healthcare directives are used. They're really used for people at the end of life. That's what fill them out for. So if you fill it out and you tell your kids that they cannot make a wrong decision because they love you, what it does is it gives them some freedom. Okay? It gives them the freedom to look at the broader question so that they can walk away saying, rather than saying, I made the decision to kill my mom or to let her die, I made that decision. They can walk away and saying, if possible, I helped my mother at the end of her life to maintain as much dignity as she could. Okay? That's that focus. And it goes on to say, let's see our time. We're doing okay. I love you and I trust you. The next paragraph, let's see where we at here. And the fourth paragraph down, I respect the skill and dedication of healthcare professionals who are advising you. I also know that healthcare professionals try to be objective, but they aren't. They are wonderful. They are wonderful human as you and I, and have a very hard time talking talking with you about dying. Witness that study. Very hard time. By the way, again, of course, the physician's reading this too, right? This is why that they will almost always talk to you about what's happening to me in a way that they are most comfortable. They will ask you about choices and decisions to start or stop particular treatments or procedures. The problem with this is that it's too easy to lose sight of the bigger picture, and that's your job. Okay? So what the hope is that what you do is you free them up from trying to be doctors. You know, what particular decision do I make? Choice do I? Treatment do I offer to being children? What's going on here? What's the larger picture? So I ask you to take courage. Ask those bigger questions. On the back page, or the next page, page two, they need assurance that you're, the healthcare system, they need assurance, the doctors, that you're not trying to pin them to a prediction about the future that only God knows. They also need assurance that they cannot, that they cannot take away the hope any more than they can predict the future. Okay? It tells the children and the healthcare system that their job is not to guess the future, or not to worry about, you know, that they could somehow take away hope, but that their job is to help you manage and figure out the course through what's going on. So, any questions? By the way, we're almost getting to the end here.
This is beautiful.
I'm reading a sentence in one paragraph that I can't quite figure out what it says.
Is that would be me.
Paragraph on the first page.
Which one?
The third paragraph.
One, two, three. Yep. Page. Yep.
It's the second highlighted sentence, second bold sentence.
Right. It says, it may well feel like right or wrong choices, but that's the surface.
That's the surface.
Right. So that's on the surface. It feels like right or wrong choices on the surface. But that's on the surface. Underneath, it's not about right or wrong choices. Then part two on the instructions here, here's where you get more specific, okay? So you said, I trust you, I trust you, I trust you. Then you say, okay, so it's okay to start some treatments. Go ahead and start them, see if I get better, you know? If I don't get better, however, you can stop those treatments too. It's okay to stop them. If there's no real chance for recovery or no reasonable hope for my interaction with those who love, that's my bottom line. That's my bottom line. How should we know? Well, there's the physician's talking to the family member saying, well, there's a 60% chance that we can get them into this treatment program, and if they do get in the treatment program, given the history, there's this, and get a lot of information, okay? Get a lot of information, and anybody is, well, should I do that or not, Doc? What should I do that or not? You know, given all those statistics. So this is, again, is trying to get back to saying, go ahead and try something if you think you need to, because I trust you, and if it doesn't work, I trust you'll stop. You'll stop. But my bottom line is, if I can't interact with you anymore as my family, if I'm just going to be there without interacting with you, it's okay not to do it. Okay? You don't have to base it on a 50% chance of me getting better. How much better? You can base it on, will I be able to really interact with you? Personally, at the point I'm in my life, I could imagine myself being a quadriplegic. I could imagine that happening to me, break my neck, even breathing through a tube, because I have a family that I want to be involved with. Right? And so I could see myself going through that difficulty in order to continue to be involved with high school age kids, college, daughter, you know. I could imagine as hard as that would be to go through that. I could also see myself in a point in my life where I would say, no, I don't want to, I'm not at the point where, in my life where that's what I want to be about. Where being quadriplegic, going through all that would be something I would, then it would be okay for me to go be with the Lord. And then if I'll go kind of quickly through the rest of it. The rest of these are guidelines, and they tend to be more ways of trying to say some of the same things. My dignity is important to me. Try to think about my dignity. What would your father want? Would it be okay for him to do it? Is this something he would want or not? And there's a number of those that go through on the page 3-2. They go through a number of those things, and they're saying things like, this I would like, this I don't want. This I kind of like, this I don't want. Okay? And you'll notice what's on here, even if you want it, just true in your heart. What is not on here is, or I guess what it is here, actually I will highlight this one to say. I thought I put it on there about going to a long-term care facility. There are many, I don't see it right now. What's not on there is saying, I don't want to go to a nursing home. Okay? That's a given. I don't have to tell anybody that. I don't want to be in a nursing home. But I want you to know that I trust you will take care of me the best way you can. And if that means I'm going to be in a nursing home at some point, that's what I have to face, or I have to do that. If you say things like, I don't want to be in a nursing home, I don't want you to start my heart again if it stops, just outright like that, what happens is it boxes people into a corner where they feel then it's a right or wrong. I can't take care of Dad. My sister doesn't live here anymore. I don't have the resources. I got to work. I can't take care of Dad. I don't have any options. What options do I have? You know, I need resources outside of myself. Okay? I can't put him in a nursing home because he told me never, ever, ever to do that. So that's that box. You get that box in. But you can say to your children, I never want to be in a nursing home. I really don't want to be in a nursing home. If it's all possible, don't. However, there are situations that we can't see. And we got to, okay? So we come to the end here, kind of come right to the end. There's a couple minutes if any of you have questions. The last part on there too is just how to make it a legal document. I will, thank you. This is five wishes. Please take one of these. It's how to make an advance directive in a number of different. This is a national one. It's becoming national. It has some checks in there. Check the boxes. Those kinds of things. That's fine to do those things. Again, be aware that this isn't a lot better than other ones in terms of the statistics of how it works. It does do one thing. The other ones, a lot of the other ones. It says how I want people to treat me, dignity, and it says what I want my loved ones to know, okay? What I want them to know. So those are the helpful things to have in your advance directive. Take these with, if you'd like a copy, fill them out. It says which states in there they are legal in, and most of the other states, if you fill this out and brought it in, you could get it adapted to your state very easily. Okay? And then also I've got some of these, which is from National Hospice Organizations, which goes into some of what I've talked about here, but it's more information on the advance directive. So thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you.